On the program tonight, less aid for legal immigrants, how the Hong Kong protests could affect the U.S. economy, and using technology from nature to fight the effects of climate change. Oh, and pumpkin spice. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Oakland, California, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, August 12th. It's good to have you with us. The Trump administration today updated rules on legal immigrants to this country. The new policy could deny green cards to immigrants who use Medicaid, food stamps, or other forms of public assistance. The administration says it wants to discourage people who are not, quote, self-sufficient from immigrating to the U.S. Immigration advocates, though, say the new rules could scare people who are already here out of asking for help. Marketplace's Andy Euler gets us started.
The Trump administration doesn't want so-called public charges to be allowed to live and work here permanently or become citizens.
Previous administrations had basically drawn the line at cash benefits.
Cash benefits like unemployment checks, according to Stephen Yale Lair, an immigration attorney at Cornell.
This administration is moving the line so that people who now receive certain non-cash benefits like Medicaid and food stamps now will be considered to possibly be ineligible for green cards.
Some conservative groups say that the new rules will be an effective way to limit immigration to self-sufficient foreigners. Mike Howell is at the Heritage Foundation.
To preserve those resources for our fellow citizens is something this rule aims to do.
Immigrant advocates are worried about spillover effects. Sarah Rosenbaum at George Washington University says children whose parents are awaiting green cards might just pull their kids out of the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, simply out of fear.
The remarkable thing was to take a program for which people are totally eligible and to say, you're eligible for these services, but if you use them, we will bar you from either coming into the U.S. or staying here.
More than 14 million enrollees in Medicaid and CHIP live in a household with a non-citizen. Even though the new rules exempt immigrant children and pregnant women on Medicaid from public charge distinction, Olivia Golden at the Center for Law and Social Policy says the new rules will likely reduce Medicaid enrollment, causing a host of problems.
Damage to, for example, hospitals and clinics, which count on a share of people being insured.
The public charge rule will take effect in 2 months. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Now to Hong Kong, where protests against the Chinese government are now in their 10th week. And the Hong Kong airport, normally one of the busiest in the world, is still essentially shut down. Most flights have been canceled after protesters swarmed the area. They were prompted by complaints of police brutality towards smaller protests over the weekend. The unrest there is not slowing down, and it's starting to take a toll on the region's economy. And as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, it has the potential to reach much further than that.
Hong Kong's economy has already begun to suffer, not simply from protests, but from basic uncertainty as to what its future looks like.
Hong Kong is reporting about a 3% contraction in its economy overall.
Robert Daly is head of the Kissinger Institute on China in the United States.
Commercial property transactions are falling, and real estate overall, the market is fragile. Tourism is down. We're starting to see issues in retail as well.
A lot is riding on China's response to the protests, according to Michael Herson with the Eurasia Group.
If Beijing intervenes in Hong Kong in a way that calls into question the one country, two systems framework, then it will give the foreign business community less confidence that Hong Kong is different from mainland China.
And Hong Kong is no longer the only launch point into China that it once was. Businesses have options from Singapore to Shenzhen. If capital flees this major financial hub, Hong Kong's currency could come under pressure.
That could have a ripple effect to emerging markets and potentially to China as well, because Hong Kong does remain a very important source of offshore financing for Chinese corporates and Chinese banks.
John Dotson edits the China Brief for the Jamestown Foundation and says the Chinese government is bolstering Hong Kong's police force rather than preparing an actual military intervention.
I do think they're very alarmed over this situation, but I also think that they're hoping to wait it out.
So for now, it's a game of chicken, with the economic and political stability of multiple regions of the world at stake. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Needless to say, games of chicken are not the kind of things that markets enjoy. They responded accordingly, and we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Climate change is here. And while that means we'll have plenty of challenges to face in the days to come, technology can help us adapt, even when that technology comes from nature. We've been covering this in our Marketplace Tech series, How We Survive. And for the series, I visited a place where rising sea levels are a real concern. Most of the San Francisco Bay Area, including a lot of Silicon Valley, is right at sea level, and in some cases slightly below. And most of that is barely protected by short dirt mounds called peat berms. They're from the 1800s, and scientists say that in the future, they're not going to cut it.
So sea level's projected to rise 7 to 10 feet by 2100.
This is Leticia Grenier, a senior scientist directing the Resilient Landscapes Program at the nonprofit San Francisco Estuary Institute. We are in San Lorenzo, California, about 30 minutes south of Oakland, at a place called the Oraloma Wastewater Treatment Plant. And we're standing right at the edge of the bay.
So 7 to 10 feet, we're underwater, right? Or at least a good part of us is. Molly's pretty tall. Molly might be a little
bit. I'm not 7 feet. No, thank you. But I'm definitely drowning.
So we're going to have to replace these little peat berms with big engineered levees. And we got to choose if we're going to have them be smaller with beautiful slopes in front of them with wetlands or big with a steep wall.
I'm here to visit a unique experiment. Researchers have actually built a smaller, more beautiful version of a levee. It's called a horizontal levee, and it's the opposite of a big, tall wall. It's basically a little 2-acre marsh with all kinds of different trees and grasses on it. And it's at the wastewater treatment plant because the plants need a lot of water. It doesn't smell the best, but it's still nice. Like a little park with birds and some planes flying overhead.
And you can hear a unique species of tidal marsh bird singing right now. It's all the tidal marsh song sparrow found nowhere else in the world except right here.
Birds aside, marshes and wetlands are good at absorbing floodwaters naturally, while concrete walls bounce the water back. They're also expensive to maintain. They might fall down in an earthquake. And then those little dirt mounds just aren't tall enough. This levee is a different kind of approach.
We have the idea of high tech. We really understand what that is. To me, that's kind of very engineering. It's similar to the steel and concrete sort of engineered levees that we see in the bay. We also have landscape tech. We have these complex natural systems that are doing really important things for us, and we need to take advantage of them and not think of that as something different and weird, but this is just a new kind of tech, and we need to use basically landscape tech to adapt to climate change.
In addition to flood resistance, the levee is also helping to clean the wastewater. Surprisingly well, in fact. Researchers say it's especially good at filtering out the trace leftovers of medicine that people take. Angela Parentoni is with the University of California, Berkeley. She's doing research on how well the plants on the horizontal levee are able to filter the water.
Naturally, medicines pass through people's bodies and end up in wastewater sometimes, and it can be really hard to deal with those compounds when they end up in the environment. But in our system, everything seems to be transformed in some way.
And not for nothing, it's a crowd pleaser. Jason Warner is general manager of the Oraloma Sanitary District. He gives lots of tours of this levee project, and he says it makes a strong case for a different approach to climate adaptation.
When people see infrastructure as a part of their community and maybe something that looks analogous to a park, they're in. They say, yes, this is the type of infrastructure that we want to see. We don't want to see giant concrete riprap levees. We want to see a natural system to that extent that we're providing a vision for people to see what sea rise response might look like. It's been a great success. We need to improve. We need to make this less expensive, and we need to make it do more.
So the levee looks good, handles floodwater, cleans wastewater. The birds love it. The vision is working, but it's expensive.
You're talking about $25 million per mile.
Jeremy Lowe is a scientist with the Estuary Institute.
We've shown the concept works. Now we've got to engineer it so that it's buildable and it's affordable,
right,
and it's legal.
By legal, he means permits for this kind of project can be really hard to get.
At the moment, this is probably illegal, unfundable, infeasible. But we're working on it.
While a horizontal wetland-style levee isn't the right answer for every place affected by rising seas, Lowe says every part of the Bay Area will eventually be affected. So any creative solution should be on the table. You can find the rest of our series, including an awesome video on the Orolomo plant, because sometimes words can't do it justice, at marketplace.org. That series, once again, is called How We Survive. We are becoming a subscription-based society, friends. Whether it's hand-picked clothes from Stitch Fix or Trunk Club, dog treats from BarkBox or Chewy, there's even a subscription service for Japanese snack foods and candy. I kind of want to sign up for that. This week, Nike got into this game with a kids' sneaker service called Nike Adventure Club. For a monthly fee, subscribers can choose between 4, 6, or 12 pairs of kids' sneakers per year to be delivered at regular intervals. The premise is simple. Make parents love the convenience because these children just keep growing, and get kids hooked on the brand. But convenience always comes with a price. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
Every fall, Akron, Ohio resident Mike Constantine helps his 10-year-old son Gavin kick off the school year with a new pair of sneakers. This year, Gavin chose a Nike pair, custom designed with his own school colors.
He can't wait to wear them on the first day of school. He's not allowed to wear them until next Tuesday. So he's looking at them and, you know, just waiting.
Constantine bought the shoes online, but Nike is hoping that parents like him would be willing to sign up to pay $20 a month to get 4 pairs a year, or as much as $50 a month to get 12 pairs. There may be savings on some pairs, but others will be sold at full retail. And it won't include the more costly basketball player signature lines, for example. Liz Cadman runs the blog My Subscription Addiction, which reviews subscription services. She says other clothing subscriptions are also going after the kids market.
A lot of our readers really find a huge value in the convenience factor of not having to take their kids shopping to a store.
Matt Powell, a sneaker industry analyst with NPD Group, says the kids' sneaker industry is worth $10 billion a year, but he's not sure aiming the subscription at kids is the right approach.
I think the biggest issue with kids' shoes is fit. Kids are obviously growing and jump up in sizes.
Nike's been testing the service for 2 years with 10,000 households and found about 15% of consumers needed to return the shoes due to fit issues. But how many pairs of sneakers do kids really need a year? Again, Dad Mike Constantine.
Maybe 2. I just don't see the added value in paying that.
To make the deal more enticing to kids, at least, Nike is offering more than just shoes, packing boxes with stickers, comics, and games. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You're not really yourself. You're your work self. And that's limiting and it's not fun.
Taking your work self online. You may not be fun, but you are nicer. First, let's do the numbers. Oh, yeah. It is the dog days of August. Stocks declined as the political crisis in Hong Kong intensified and bond yields continued their downward spiral. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 391 points, 1.4%, to close at 25,896. The Nasdaq lost 95 points, just 1.2%, to finish at 7,863. And the S&P 500 sliced off 35 points, also 1.2%, to end at 2,882. In the banking sector, Goldman Sachs was down 2.6%, JP Morgan Chase fell 1.8%, and Bank of America, which today raised its forecast for chances of a recession in the next year to 1 and 3, declined 2.4%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.63%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. There is a long and all too familiar feeling list of reasons we're having a housing crisis in this country. Among the familiar, there's a flat out shortage of homes in many cities and towns, and the shortage of affordable homes is even worse. But one thing that doesn't get so much attention is the role of residential zoning in all this, specifically rules that allow only detached single family houses in certain areas. Earlier this year, the city of Minneapolis abolished single-family zoning in most of the city. The Oregon legislature did the same for much of the state. But simply adding density may not get you more of a good thing. Marketplace's Amy Scott brings us more from Denver.
Walk around parts of Denver's Berkeley neighborhood, and you'll see a strange mix of houses. Century-old bungalows with big yards and front porches, and three-story modern duplexes with balconies and roof decks. From the looks of it, the duplexes are winning.
Here's another single story that's going to be demolished. It's got the fence up. And
another duplex
and another
next door.
New one. Yep.
Bill Killam has lived here for 30 years and volunteers with Historic Berkeley Regis, a neighborhood preservation group. He says the invasion of the duplexes started about 10 years ago.
As we were coming out of the recession, a lot of these houses were able to be bought up fairly inexpensively because it was at the bottom of the market.
Developers saw they could make a lot of money tearing down one little house and replacing it with two big ones under one roof. And as Denver became a magnet for young professionals, there was plenty of demand, but also plenty of longtime residents who hated these 5,000 square foot boxes built practically to the lot lines. And in 2010, when the city went through a big rezoning process, officials put on the brakes.
The 2010 zoning code actually downzoned about 75% of Denver to single family as a result of that pushback.
Architect Goja Kung says so much of the city was suddenly off limits for this kind of building, there was a frenzy to grab what was left.
There are these few pockets. Those are the ones that are targeted by developers.
Developers like Jay Feaster.
I don't have horns, even though I know some folks would say that I probably do.
He shows me one of his duplexes in a neighborhood called Sunnyside. Each side has three bedrooms and four bathrooms, huge windows, gleaming white cabinets, hardwood floors.
My wife refers to the kitchen island as the aircraft carrier because it's 13-something feet long.
Now, in theory, two connected homes where there used to be one is what a growing city like Denver needs. Duplexes are part of what's called the missing middle between apartment buildings and detached single-family homes. But as the city has boomed and land has gotten more expensive, so have the houses. Each half of this duplex went for more than $800,000. Feaster says restricting density to a few areas has pushed up prices.
I feel like if they didn't concentrate the zoning, number one, it would help prices stay a lot more attainable. But simultaneously, you wouldn't have all these three-story units because people would try to be blending into the neighborhood more.
Feaster says he's been trying by building more two-story duplexes with traditional features like pitched roofs and big front porches. But it's not just the architecture that bugs people. As we talked on the roof deck, I noticed a TV crew down below, interviewing the next-door neighbor on the front stoop of his bungalow. His name is Bobby Lefebvre, and he'd written a play about what's happening to his part of the city. I went to see it.
I remember when it was called the North Side.
Now they are calling it the Highlands.
North Side is about a young Chicano couple trying to buy a house in their working-class neighborhood as it gentrifies. They end up in a bidding war with a white couple from the suburbs.
If we don't get into something here soon, I don't know if we'll be able to afford it later.
Sometimes I look at what it's become, and I wonder if it's even worth sticking around for.
Lefebvre, the playwright, didn't want to be interviewed. But I talked to one of the actors, Angel Mendez Soto, who's lived in Sunnyside for more than 40 years. The upside of all this development, his house is worth more than 10 times what he paid for it in the 80s. On the other hand, the bungalow next door has been replaced by one of those giant duplexes with a roof deck.
Before, you sit on the porch and you'd be the neighbors sitting on the porch across, and you know, that might be a cross conversation. But you know, how do you talk to somebody who's looking down on you? It's a very weird situation.
A situation city officials say they plan to address with zoning changes that promote what's been called gentle density, adding much needed housing without destroying the character of the existing neighborhood. In Denver, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Now to the internet, which is uniformly a disaster, right? Facebook, Twitter, YouTube have been on the defensive for years now over everything from privacy issues to misinformation to radicalizing extremist users to fake news. But one social media network has largely remained a conflict-free zone, LinkedIn. The Microsoft-owned site is where people, for the most part, politely share resumes, network with other professionals, post inspirational achievement-related notes, and represent their jobs. John Herman covers tech and media for the New York Times. He wrote about what's working, no pun intended, at LinkedIn. John, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me on.
So what is LinkedIn doing right?
Well, yeah, I would say it's certainly about work, and that's sort of the key. And so that brings with it fairly rigid expectations for how you're supposed to behave and what types of things you're supposed to talk about. Obviously, there are plenty of exceptions to this, and people get into all kinds of conversations on LinkedIn, but they behave largely as they would in an office place, which is to say in a deliberate way that you don't see on other social networks.
One other thing you point out in the piece is that LinkedIn is also a bit of a gated community in that a lot of the people who are on that network pay to be there.
Yeah.
So does that mean that it's sort of success in this way can't necessarily be translated to a big free teeming public market?
Yeah, it's an inherently limited environment in what you can do, who you can talk to. It would make a forum for free discussion of ideas fairly dysfunctional. The fact that you have to pay to send messages to people you don't know, that's a blunt force way to at least cut down on certain kinds of conflict and harassment and stuff like that. It has narrowed things down in a way that other social networks don't and honestly can't. That's contrary to their needs.
Mm-hmm. Are there specific chunks, though? Like, as you wrote this, are there specific things that happen on LinkedIn that you think could be translated to Facebook or Twitter or Reddit?
Yeah. You know, this idea that LinkedIn has this sort of normative consensus, we're here for work. There is not this sort of inherent need to promote controversial content. The problem is engagement is how these companies make their money. Attention is how they make their money. On LinkedIn, you know, engagement and attention matter, but there are about 20 ways you can pay for LinkedIn, and they're selling you all the time. Their main business line isn't getting you to spend 5 hours there in an argument. You might say that that is Facebook's main business line. And so that's an option they do have.
Now, all of this said, I can't say I spend a ton of time on LinkedIn. Like, how much would you say you use it?
Oh, very little. But, you know, I'm currently employed and not seeking to change that. LinkedIn just zeroes in on one purpose. And if you have a need for that purpose, that is to talk to your professional peers, to get in touch with a future employer, to suck up to a current employer. If these things are good for you, it's a place where you can spend plenty of time.
Right. But it's sort of like work is work and all the fun happens elsewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And no one's wondering where the fun videos are on LinkedIn. I mean, some people try, but the default is corniness. And again, you're sort of in a giant virtual office. You're not really yourself. You're your work self. And that's limiting. And it's not fun. And it has enormous disadvantages generally, but it is what you are at work. And so you're also not there, you know, starting a giant social media war.
John Herman covers tech and media for the New York Times. Thank you so much for the time.
Thanks for having me on.
This final note on the way out. Most of you regular listeners will know that Kai Rizdahl is not a fan of the pumpkin spice. But apparently everyone else can't get enough. Dunkin' Donuts reported today that pumpkin spice consumption hit a 5-year high in 2018. And it is kicking off the spice season, if you will, on Wednesday. Already, it will rename 8 of its restaurants Pumpkin. Get it? Dunkin' Pumpkin. And hand out free pumpkin-flavored drinks and lip balm in stores. The full Dunkin' Pumpkin Spice menu arrives August 21st. Starbucks, for what it's worth, has yet to announce its release date. Kai, just know I don't feel good about this. All right, we got to go. Wall Street also did not feel good today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average down 391 points, 1.4%. The NASDAQ down 95 points, 1.2%. And the S&P 500 was down 35 points. That's also 1.2%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Our special projects desk includes Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. I am Molly Wood, and we'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.